The final investigator I chatted with was Dr. Angela Secord, who began our conversation by presenting a 74-year-old woman from her practice.
This is a patient I had the pleasure of meeting a few months ago. She was admitted to the hospital on the medicine service with ascites and horrible performance status. She was having a very difficult time in terms of her strength and ability to perform her activities of daily living. And while she was admitted, they found that she had a large pelvic mass. I was actually asked to consult on her because of the findings of the pelvic mass and ascites.
Now, you said her performance status was poor. For how long? Had she been in good condition recently?
She had been until 3 weeks or so prior to admission when things really started to become worse.
So she was pretty well functioning 74-year-old who was kind of deteriorating.
Absolutely, but she did have some medical issues. She actually had a prior history of small cell lung cancer treated with chemotherapy and radiation.
And that was in 2005?
That's right.
Wow, and so she...
She had coronary artery disease and had a three-vessel CABG in 2004. So she definitely had some medical issues. And one of the issues that we had to determine was whether this was truly an ovarian cancer or was this metastatic lung cancer.
Right. And about how long ago did you see her for the first time?
It was probably about 3 months ago.
Okay. So I guess the small cell was in 2005. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about, you know, kind of what was going on and what the evaluation showed.
Well, so the evaluation demonstrated that she had a large amount of ascites. Her laboratory evaluation, she had an increased CA125, and she also had an albumin that was less than 3. And probably most important is that we obtained a fine needle guided biopsy of this mass, and the pathology was consistent with an ovarian primary rather than a metastatic lung cancer.
So you're faced with a lady with a pretty interesting past history who now has pretty extensive disease in her abdomen. How are you thinking through her options at that point?
Well, I think in this situation, it's easy to decide what's the best route of treatment because of her poor performance status and the malnutrition and the tense ascites that we opted to treat her with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And I think that is a big change from what may have been done 10, 15 years ago, where most of these patients would have probably undergone a laparotomy procedure.
You think she could have tolerated a laparotomy?
No, I do not think she could have. She was pretty weak at that point from the malignancy.
So what actually happened? What did you do?
So we treated her with chemotherapy, which has been difficult too because of her prior treatments with chemotherapy. But we opted to treat her with neoadjuvant carboplatin initially, and then we added paclitaxel.
And what happened?
She's responding so far, and it's too early to determine if we're going to do some operative intervention, but that's hopefully my goal. And she's received, at this point, her third treatment.
Now, did you consider the possibility of adding in bevacizumab?
Not in this situation. I think there's a lot of interest in bevacizumab, but I think that given her other medical issues and my goal to proceed with interval surgical debulking, I was not too enthusiastic about adding a third agent.
Now, did you have to do anything more about her ascites, or you just treated it with the chemo?
Just treated it with the chemotherapy, and her ascites has responded.
And what's going on in terms of her performance status?
Her performance status has improved. She's able to spend most of her time probably up and out of a bed or a chair at this point. She's much stronger. Her nutrition has also improved. One of the difficult issues I've had is bone marrow suppression. And so we've had to work around her chemotherapy doses and reduce some of the drugs. And I've actually gone to a weekly approach with the paclitaxel, but not a dose-dense weekly approach. I want to clarify that, just sort of a weekly regimen that we've used before at Duke that she's tolerating much better.
And you mentioned that your approach to her using neoadjuvant therapy is different than it might have been a while back. What's behind the thinking?
Well, you know, initially there were retrospective series demonstrating that neoadjuvant therapy followed by surgical debulking was an option for select patients. And, you know, I would say that during my residency and fellowship, most of these patients would have had surgery. But in the last 10 years, there was some thought that these individuals who are very weak from their cancer, have a poor nutritional status, have tense ascites, may benefit from this neoadjuvant approach. And then just recently, a European study was published by Dr. Vergote and his colleagues. They randomized patients with advanced stage disease to these two approaches, either neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by surgery or primary debulking surgery followed by chemotherapy. And while I do think there are some concerns about that study, their overall results demonstrated that there was no difference in survival in patients who were treated with these different approaches.
So what do those findings mean to you?
So it makes me feel more comfortable when I have patients such as this that I'm not doing the wrong thing by offering them neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And patients who, you know, they're select candidates for this approach. I think the criteria that I've already mentioned, as well as those patients who have unresectable disease, such as liver disease involving the porta hepatis or widely metastatic disease, that you're not going to be able to resect fully.
Any sort of overall global estimate of what the chance of response is to neoadjuvant therapy like this, and particularly what the chances of progression?
So clinically, in my experience, probably about 70% plus patients respond to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. There may be just a small handful of patients that don't respond to this approach.
And at what point do you think in her particular situation you're going to be thinking about surgery?
So we're going to reassess how she's doing after this third treatment, and we'll make a decision at that point. We'll probably obtain a CT scan to evaluate the pulmonary nodules that were seen previously to see if there's any difference in those, and to evaluate how she's doing from, you know, basically her strength, her physical ability to tolerate surgical procedure.
Now, what would you be thinking about post-operatively in terms of systemic therapy? I'm sure that maybe was going to change based on how the surgery goes, but what are sort of the different routes you might be taking?
In this patient, I would choose to treat with intravenous chemotherapy. There are some patients that, you know, are healthier, have less comorbidities, that I would discuss and even recommend intraperitoneal therapy.
What fraction of patients with ovarian cancer present, sort of like this woman did, would you say?
I would say it's probably in the 20-30% range. But it depends. You know, the patients who present coming into the hospital are very different from the patients that you see in clinic. And so in terms of patients who I see for consultation in the hospital arena, the majority present the way she did. But if I take all my ovarian cancer patients overall, it's not the majority.
So in terms of the majority, which I assume would mean not as extensive disease, not as debilitated, it's still, I mean, the majority of people present, I guess, with sort of gross abdominal disease. Is that true?
That's absolutely correct. Approximately 70% of women will present with advanced stage 3C disease.
So what's your strategy for a patient who's not as sick or not as extensive in terms of whether or not to do neoadjuvant therapy or not?
Well, I look at the same considerations, such as their performance status, nutrition, and their other comorbidities, as well as the extent of disease. But if they have disease that I feel that is potentially resectable, I will recommend a surgical approach initially, followed by chemotherapy.
And what about post-surgery? How do you think through options in that situation, particularly in terms of intraperitoneal therapy that you were referring to, and also the potential of using bevacizumab?
So most of our patients, if not all, we discuss intraperitoneal chemotherapy with them, and we include placement of an intraperitoneal catheter on their operative consent. I think that the majority of my patients are interested in intraperitoneal therapy, but I definitely am very forward with how challenging sometimes this treatment is, because it is more difficult than an intravenous approach. There is more toxicity, but I think that the benefits outweigh the toxicity. And so most of my patients do opt to consider placement of an intraperitoneal catheter. And right now we have two different studies that are open at Duke that are both being supported by the gynecologic oncology group. One is for patients who are optimally cytoreduced. That's GOG 252. And one of the challenges on that study is that one arm does not include intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So in those patients, sometimes you're placing a catheter and then they may opt to go on this study. And on the study, there's one arm that's only intravenous therapy.
What are the arms of the study?
So I mentioned the intravenous therapy arm. And this study is very different in that there's not a classic standard chemotherapy arm. The intravenous therapy arm evaluates a dose-dense chemotherapy approach. So the patient's getting weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin. And the carboplatin is dosed every 3 weeks, which is traditional. And then the second arm evaluates, again, this dose-dense weekly approach, but the intraperitoneal therapy is using carboplatin. And the third arm is intraperitoneal chemotherapy with paclitaxel dosed on day 1 and 8. And then the intraperitoneal therapy is cisplatin. And that is really based on data from the GOG 172 intraperitoneal chemotherapy study.
Now, am I correct in saying that in all three arms they receive bevacizumab?
Yes, bevacizumab is included in all the arms of that study.
And, you know, I find that kind of interesting. Obviously, there's been a huge controversy about bevacizumab in this situation since the last ASCO meeting when the GOG study was first presented. Been very much discussed, shall we say. How do you feel about the fact that, you know, essentially all three arms in this study, the patient, and they receive it for, was it 15 months, is it?
In 252, they may have changed that so that they receive bevacizumab until progression.
Which is different
from GOG 218.
Right.
So I think the results from GOG 218, which, as you mentioned, were presented at ASCO in June of last year, were very interesting. There was a lot of controversy about the results. Certainly the study met its endpoint in that there was an improvement in progression-free survival. And at that point, they had not yet presented quality of life information or overall survival. But subsequently, the European study evaluating bevacizumab, ICON-7, was presented as well. And in this study, there was also a progression-free survival benefit. The overall survival data is not expected until 2012. So hopefully next year we'll receive an update. And I think that, you know, now we have two studies showing this progression-free survival benefit. There may be more interest in bevacizumab incorporation in frontline therapy. The big issue, honestly, I think, is the cost of the drug. And do these benefits of progression-free survival, do they trump an overall survival benefit? But that's a separate controversy to discuss when you're treating someone off protocol. In context of a clinical trial, I think it is appropriate to include bevacizumab in all the arms of GOG 252.
What have your discussions with patients been like about bevacizumab since these data have been presented?
You know, I think that because so many of our patients are either being treated on protocol, or if they're not being treated on protocols because they're receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy, that there hasn't been a lot of discussion about bevacizumab use in my practice, at least in the frontline treatment. But I think that if I had a patient who opted not to go on the study, then it's certainly something that we discuss. And so far, I haven't had a lot of interest in receiving that drug off of protocol.
And you mentioned there was another major study that's open that you're participating in. Which one is that?
That's GOG 262. So that study is open for patients who have ovarian cancer who were suboptimally cytoreduced. So they still have disease volumes defined as greater than 1 centimeter. In this study, the bevacizumab treatment is optional. The patient decides if they want to receive bevacizumab. This study schema, it's two arms, and the first arm is this traditional paclitaxel and carboplatin dosing every 3 weeks, and the second regimen is evaluating dose-dense weekly paclitaxel. And so paclitaxel in this treatment arm is delivered on days 1, 8, and 15, and there's no breaks. And the dose of paclitaxel is 80 milligrams per meter squared. And then carboplatin dosing is similar, and is every 3 weeks. And as I mentioned, the bevacizumab is optional. What I did hear, though, is that most patients on the study are receiving bevacizumab, that they decide they want that drug. And maintenance therapy is continued until disease progression or toxicity.
Okay, that's interesting. How about your 43-year-old woman?
So this is a wonderful lady who was initially diagnosed with a stage 2C serous papillary adenocarcinoma several years ago, and she underwent a complete surgical staging and was without evidence disease until 3 years later, and she was found to have an isolated 6 centimeter pelvic mass. And so we actually did her secondary debulking laparoscopically and included a rectal semi resection and reanastomosis, and she had no evidence of disease after surgery, and we did treat her with chemotherapy.
What about the issue of debulking by laparoscopy?
So, you know, I don't think this has been well studied. I'm not aware of any phase 3 trials evaluating laparoscopic versus traditional laparotomy for debulking. I have done a few cases in this way. And, you know, I think as our technology improves and our ability to debulk ovarian cancer, either with traditional laparoscopy or even robotics, that there will be more enthusiasm for this type of approach. One of my concerns has been with laparoscopy is that you can't feel. And sometimes it's very important to feel around the peritoneal cavity and make sure you're not missing any implants that may not be detected either by radiologic imaging or you can't visualize. And so I've moved to doing some of these procedures with a hand-assisted approach because that way I can at least feel the peritoneal surfaces and make sure I'm not missing any of these masses, because I do think it is so crucial to debulk patients to essentially no disease. I'm not 100% sold on it. I can say that postoperatively, the patients all do very well. In terms of my clinical experience, I think that, you know, I don't detect a difference in clinical outcome, but, you know, the patients who have the least amount of disease are the patients that I'm operating on in this manner. So that's probably not a huge surprise that there's no difference in clinical outcome.
So then what was the next step with her?
I did offer her treatment on a clinical trial. It was GOG 213. This trial is still open. And this trial is answering two very important questions. And one of them is the surgical debulking question. You know, I do think that when patients recur, that we should evaluate their disease carefully to assess the extent of their cancers, and that certain patients with recurrent ovarian cancer are candidates for secondary debulking. The retrospective data, there's multiple studies reporting successful outcomes of secondary debulking. But one of the issues is that this is a very select patient population. So in GOG 213, patients who are candidates for surgery are randomized to either a surgical approach followed by chemotherapy or chemotherapy alone. And I did offer her participation on this study, but she declined. I think, again, it just highlights the bias that physicians have as well as patients may have for one approach over the other.
It does kind of sound like a tough thing to, you know, randomize somebody to debulking surgery or not.
Yes, absolutely. I would say that of my patients that I discuss this study with, maybe 30% of them will agree to enroll if they're surgical candidates. And most have a bias towards surgery. But at any rate, she did very well. And then postoperatively, we had to discuss what treatment options we would pursue. And I treated her with liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin at that point based on an abstract that was presented at ASCO. And now that study's been published, and that's a Calypso trial.
Yeah, that was a really interesting study. Can you talk about what they looked at and what it meant to you? You know, I think it kind of went under the radar of a lot of people.
I think that's a very important study that's been presented in the last 2 years in ovarian cancer. So in this study, it was very well designed. It was a non-inferiority trial design, and they evaluated two different regimens, liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin versus paclitaxel and carboplatin, which I think is probably the traditional go-to regimen for platinum-sensitive disease. And what they found is that the clinical outcome was improved for patients who received the liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin therapy. And there was a very striking difference in the toxicity profile, with less alopecia and less neurotoxicity for patients who were treated with liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin. And I think those are two very important considerations for patients.
Can I ask you, in terms of that Calypso study, sort of how that impacted you in terms of treatment off study in general?
Well, it definitely changed my recommendations. For someone who has platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer, you know, I just continue to offer them treatment on clinical trials, but off of a protocol, I recommend the treatment with combination liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin.
And is it your clinical experience that it's, you know, less toxic than carboplatin?
I wouldn't necessarily say less toxic. I think the toxicity pattern is different. You know, sometimes for patients, it's very important that they don't have hair loss. And then there's some patients that have persistent neuropathy from their initial chemotherapy. But for the liposomal doxorubicin arm, it was no surprise. There's more mucositis. There's more palmar plantar erythema or the hand-foot syndrome. One of the interesting things about this study that I thought was very interesting is that there tended to be less allergic reactions with carboplatin on patients who were treated with the liposomal doxorubicin compared to those patients who were treated with paclitaxel. And initially, I thought that was probably due to the treatment interval. It's every 4 weeks with the liposomal doxorubicin arm and every 3 weeks with paclitaxel. But there was another report by Dr. Markham. They did a study evaluating carboplatin versus liposomal doxorubicin and carboplatin. And they found similarly that there were less allergic reactions with that combination of treatment.
Some kind of interaction of the drugs, do you think?
You know, I'm not sure at this point, but it's certainly interesting. And what often does happen with these patients is as they have repeated exposure to carboplatin, they are more likely to react, which can make it more challenging to treat them.
So what's this woman's current situation?
Well, she did well for quite some time, but she wanted to stop treatment probably a little early because of quality of life issues, and she wanted to continue working, which I think is so important. You know, these patients, for the most part, don't have a disease that we can cure, but we can treat. But we also have to be very mindful of their quality of life issues. And so she opted to come off of therapy, and she recently recurred.
And what are you thinking as the next step?
So I tried a treatment on a phase one trial with a combination with gemcitabine and an experimental agent, and she just did not tolerate it well. So she came off study, but we continued the gemcitabine, and I've added bevacizumab.
And now what's going on?
She's responding to that. Her cancer symptoms have decreased, and her CA125 has decreased as well.
What kind of symptoms did she have at the time you started the GEM-BEV, and where was the tumor?
It's abdominal pain, and she had tumor involvement in the right upper quadrant.
And did she have ascites also?
No ascites.
What is your experience with bevacizumab, both with chemo as in her, as well as a single agent in advanced disease, particularly with people with ascites?
Right. Well, I definitely find that the drug works. You know, it definitely has activity in ovarian cancer. We were very fortunate at Duke to have phase one studies involving bevacizumab early in 2001, 2002, probably. So I had patients who were involved in some of these phase one trials. And one of these trials, they allowed patients to receive bevacizumab for the first treatment. And then afterwards, you could add whatever chemotherapy regimen of choice you wanted to. And so that provided some experience for me with these combinations. So, you know, there's certain combinations that I like and use more than others. Perhaps there was a study evaluating low-dose cyclophosphamide and bevacizumab that had a significant clinical benefit in a lot of patients. That was published by Dr. Garcia and his colleagues. And I like that combination. I've also used gemcitabine and bevacizumab as well. And there's been a lot of studies presented, you know, at various meetings, and particularly ASCO, that have evaluated a wide variety of drugs, topotecan, mab, paclitaxel, docetaxel, liposomal doxorubicin. I mean, several different agents that have been combined with bevacizumab, and some showing activity.
What about bevacizumab alone without chemo? Is that something you use?
Yes, I've used that as well, too. You know, in the GOG study that I think was a pivotal phase two trial that was published by Dr. Berger on behalf of GOG, there was approximately 20% response rate, and 40% of patients had no evidence of progression at 6 months, which was a surprise. They hadn't seen that type of activity as a single agent with bevacizumab and other tumor types.
I'm just flashing on some of my conversations with your colleague in neuro-oncology, Jim Vredenburg. And it's kind of interesting, you know, trying to look at the whole spectrum of where you see responses to bevacizumab across different tumors. And I don't know, just sort of globally, ovarian cancer, Jim's glioblastoma, and maybe renal cancer seem sort of unique in having, you know, substantial single agent activity. Any specific experiences where you've seen useful clinical responses?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the issues too, you know, just to bring this up, you're talking about using bevacizumab in frontline. And, you know, one of the issues that people bring up is, where is the best location for this drug? Is it frontline, or is it second line, or with recurrent disease? And I don't think we absolutely know that. I don't think we really know, or we don't really have great data right now to say that bevacizumab needs to be stopped when patients have disease that progressed, or should we just add a different chemotherapeutic agent? There's a very interesting study that's being done in Europe called the Aurelia study for patients who have recurrent ovarian cancer. And I believe it's for patients who have platinum-resistant disease. And in one arm, they receive chemotherapy only. In the other arm, they receive chemotherapy in addition to bevacizumab. And then when they progress in that first arm that got chemotherapy only, they can receive bevacizumab. The other important aspect of this study is that patients are allowed to enroll even if they've been previously treated with bevacizumab. So hopefully once the results of this study are presented, we'll have a better idea about the use of this agent upon disease progression if you're already using it.
What do you see in this woman's future, and are there any new agents or new strategies coming up that you think maybe you're going to be thinking about with her?
Well, I think we should always consider clinical trials if they're available. Certainly in terms of new agents, I think one of the most exciting agents are the PARP inhibitors. So, you know, that if there's a clinical trial that's available and she's a candidate for that, I would definitely consider treatment on that study. And then the other exciting drugs include mTOR inhibitors, as well as vascular disrupting agents. And then additional anti-angiogenic drugs include Amgen 386, as well as there's an endocyte compound, EC145. So in terms of the drugs that I think are really exciting and novel, those would be my top five candidates or classes of agents.
So I'd like to kind of pick up on a few of those things, and particularly the PARP inhibitors. And let me just ask as a prelude, what about BRCA testing and ovarian cancer? And did you think about BRCA testing her?
Well, we've probably discussed it with her because of her young age, but she has not undergone testing at this point that I can recall anyway. I think that when you have somebody that is this young and they're responding to chemotherapy, that you need to obviously consider that they may have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. I mean, my feeling is I offer patients genetic counseling, and then after they go through the counseling, they can decide whether or not they want to have the testing performed. And some people opt not to have that testing done. Now, the question in the past has been, you know, to know your risk for other malignancies or to, you know, alert family members to the fact that you have this predisposition to malignancy so that they could get tested as well. But one of the things that we have to consider now is the directing treatment based on whether or not you have one of these mutations or another targeted abnormality that we can use a therapy to target that specifically. So, you know, that's something that I can probably discuss with her. But even if she tested BRCA1 or 2 negative, I don't think that would prevent me from considering a PARP trial.
In terms of sort of indications to send a patient to a genetic counselor to consider this, what specific things do you look for? And particularly, what about the age?
Right. If they have a premenopausal history of breast cancer and now they developed ovarian cancer, definitely. If they have a significant family history of either ovarian or breast cancer, or if they're Ashkenazi Jewish descent. The other things I evaluate as well are whether they have a history of colon cancer, because, you know, now when we're screening people for these genetic predispositions, we're not just thinking about BRCA1 or 2, we're thinking about Lynch syndrome as well. And Lynch syndrome can be associated with colorectal cancers or other cancers of the small intestine or stomach, or even some urologic cancers. So I think that the spectrum is increased dramatically. And I should also add for Lynch syndrome, endometrial cancers.
And maybe you can provide an update on PARP inhibitors. There was a really exciting presentation in ASCO last year where I don't remember seeing a study where you had people who were non-BRCA positive clearly responding. I think that was olaparib.
Mm-hmm. So they did provide an update for that study at our recent meeting at Society of Gynecologic Oncology, as well as there were some other studies presented by Dr. Winham evaluating PARP inhibitors. And, you know, there does appear to be a subset of patients that, although they do not have a germline mutation in BRCA1 or 2, have cancers that respond to these agents. So that's, you know, one of our challenges moving forward is to determine who's best going to respond to this drug. And there's this term called BRCA-ness. So it's not necessarily that they have a genetic mutation in BRCA1 or 2, but they may have these epigenetic abnormalities that lead to dysregulation of BRCA1 or 2 function or dysfunction of other genes involved in DNA repair. So I think that we're just touching the tip of the iceberg, if you will, in determining who's best going to respond to these agents.
You also mentioned AMG 386, and again, I remember there was a presentation at ASCO last year that a lot of people were impressed with. How does that agent work? What do we know about it right now?
So this is a really interesting agent. It targets the angiopoietins, and the angiopoietins are also involved in angiogenesis. And so when they inhibit the interaction of this ligand with the receptor, it inhibits angiogenesis. So it was very interesting in this study. There's three different arms that I recall, and Dr. Carlin presented this data. And there appeared to be activity in both arms, one using a higher dose of the drug. And there's so much interest in this agent that this is now moving into a phase 3 trial with Amgen 386 in ovarian cancer. And specifically, I think it's targeting women who have this recurrent disease that's deemed intermediate platinum sensitive, so they recur at the 6 to 12 month period. So the other very interesting thing about this drug is that it did not appear to have the hypertension side effect that we've noticed with bevacizumab.
What other new agents are out there? I know there are a couple that you kind of have been involved with or are going to be involved with that you were mentioning to me, Dasatinib, as well as so-called BIBF 1120. What about those two agents?
So I think, you know, those are on my personal radar of drugs that I think are of interest. The BIBF 1120 drug is currently being evaluated in Europe in several studies. And what we're specifically interested here is evaluating that agent in women who have bevacizumab-resistant disease, or basically women who are on bevacizumab and their cancers progressing despite this treatment. And there's several different thoughts about why resistance to bevacizumab can develop. So what we have to remember about that drug is it targets vascular endothelial growth factor, which is probably, you know, one of the most potent growth factors that promotes angiogenesis. But angiogenesis is very complicated. And so there's all these other pathways involved. We've mentioned the angiopoietins, but there's, you know, platelet-derived growth factor and basic fibroblast growth factor, just to name a few. And it's thought that maybe these secondary pathways start to be promoted when you're blocking vascular endothelial growth factor pathway. And our thought is, could we use another agent that targets, you know, these multiple other pathways, such as BIBF 1120? And could we get that cancer to regress again with this agent, even in the setting of bevacizumab resistance? So that's where we're very interested in this drug.
But just before you go into the other one, what do we know about the mechanism of action of the drug?
It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
And what does it block?
So it blocks many of those secondary pathways that I mentioned. It also blocks vascular endothelial growth factor receptor. So it blocks at the receptor level, not necessarily by binding the ligand like bevacizumab does, as well as platelet-derived growth factor receptors and others. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that we're interested in this drug. Instead of just targeting one of these receptors, it's targeting a whole cadre of them.
And have you actually treated anybody with it yet?
No, I haven't. This drug is not available out of a clinical trial, and we have not had a clinical trial that my patients have been eligible for anyway at Duke.
And what do we know about side effects and toxicity?
So one of the side effects with this agent can be diarrhea and then elevation of liver enzymes.
And I'm guessing that goes away when you stop the drug?
Yeah, I believe both are reversible.
You also mentioned you were involved with work on Dasatinib. What do we know about that in ovarian cancer?
So Dasatinib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor as well. It targets SARC as well as several other pathways, BCR-ABL, c-KIT, platelet-derived growth factor, and then FA2, just to name the most prominent pathways involved. And this was an agent, it actually has been studied as a single agent already in ovarian cancer and showed limited activity. So I don't think there's a lot of interest in studying this agent further as a single therapeutic modality. But what we're interested in is evaluating this drug in addition to chemotherapy. This drug is FDA approved for the use in chronic myelogenous leukemia. So what our lab studies have shown is that when we combine this with chemotherapy agents, there is either an additive or synergistic response in a lot of the ovarian cancer cell lines that we've studied. And so one of the studies that we conducted was a phase one trial of paclitaxel, carboplatin, and dasatinib. And we found that a number of patients either responded or had stable disease. But, you know, again, do we know that this drug in combination with those two other chemotherapy drugs is going to be superior to just paclitaxel and carboplatin? No, we don't know that from that study. But it's certainly an interesting agent, and I hope we can continue to evaluate it further.
So maybe we can just talk about your next patient.
This patient, I really wanted to present her basically to discuss maintenance therapy, because I think that's such a hot topic. And this was a patient who had advanced stage disease, who underwent surgery, and her cancer was optimally resected. She had some disease remaining at the conclusion of the procedure, but it was less than 1 centimeter. And she had a complete remission to chemotherapy. Her CA125 normalized, her exam was negative, her radiologic imaging studies were negative. And so we had a lengthy discussion about treatment regimens at that point. And I think alternatives include continued surveillance or maintenance therapy. There's been a number of strategies evaluated. And then fortunately, we have a trial at Duke that's GOG212. And we offered her participation on that study. And she agreed to participate. And this study, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but it had 3 different arms. And
no.
One of the arms is just surveillance, and the other arm is paclitaxel, and the other arm is this study that's a form of paclitaxel known as Zyotac. But anyway, I think it's very important that there's that arm of surveillance on that study, because we're going to be able to assess something that's very important, and that's quality of life. And so it may be, you know, that we can improve the time before the cancer recurs with these treatment strategies, but what is someone's quality of life compared to those who are monitored closely but aren't receiving maintenance therapy? So at any rate, she was randomized to the surveillance arm, and she's doing well. And interestingly, that was the arm that she wanted. So, you know, it's very interesting that it all goes back to patients' biases. Some patients feel very strongly that they want a treatment. Some patients feel very strongly that they don't want any more further treatment. On the note of consolidation or maintenance strategies, I think that it's very important to note that there's still interest in vaccine strategies, which I think are also very interesting. And there's going to be a presentation, I believe, at ASCO regarding abrogovimab, which is a vaccine strategy against CA125. And we'll see what that study shows.
So how is that actually made, so to speak? Or what is it? It's a vaccine against CA125?
Right. And these vaccines are all very interesting. And this is a little different. There was an earlier study using ovogovimab, which was the OVERX trial. And these two vaccines are somewhat different in terms of the types of antibodies they are. And I am not a vaccine expert, but I know that there's several around our country and I can name names. But Dr. Sabatini, for instance, at Memorial Sloan Kettering can explain this very well. But essentially, the OVERX trial was completed showing no difference in outcome for the patients who are vaccinated versus non-vaccinated. And this trial is going to be presented this year. And so we'll see if this different, somewhat slightly different antibody approach will result in any difference in clinical outcome. There's also other studies we've been evaluating at Duke, including a vaccine strategy against multiple different antigens, because it may be that just vaccinating against one antigen isn't enough. You need to vaccinate against basically a cocktail of antigens to get the effect. And we've just completed some pilot studies in that arena. And basically what we were evaluating mostly is how well they could tolerate the drug and if we were getting antibody responses. And then there's another very interesting study evaluating a dendritic vaccine. So, you know, I think that certainly there's a lot of interest in maintenance strategies. There's been a lot of different strategies evaluated, including continuing chemotherapy, similar to the GOG-212 study, evaluating different types of chemotherapy compared to what somebody got frontline. Bevacizumab is really a maintenance strategy, in my opinion, as well as these vaccines.
What do you tend to do with patients outside of a study?
You know, it really depends on what their desires are, what their feelings are. Often my patients are very tired of receiving chemotherapy, and if they're going to be treated off study, they'll probably opt for no further treatment.
You know, I was thinking about that vaccine. I was mentioning I work with your colleague Dan George in prostate cancer, and there they were talking a lot about sipulucel T. It kind of seems like a similar strategy.
Well, I think there's differences in that strategy. I believe that's a dendritic vaccine.
It is, right.
And right. So one of the studies that we have right now is evaluating a dendritic vaccine, which is, I mean, that's very exciting, but it's very time intensive for patients in terms of they undergo leukapheresis. It's basically a personalized vaccine, I think, you know, for them. So I'm very excited about that approach. And I do have patients currently that I've offered that study to. But, you know, sometimes these patients are pretty tired of undergoing their chemotherapy. So it's going to be a select individual who opts to participate in those trials.
I'm curious now, we're coming up on, I guess it's about 2 years since the Rustin presentation at ASCO in 2009 about the issue of monitoring of CA125 in ovarian cancer. I'm kind of curious sort of what's happened in the oncologic or gynecologic oncology community since that time. Maybe you can just sort of briefly summarize what they saw and whether you think it's had any impact on your practice or anybody else's.
So I'm not aware of any surveys that have evaluated medical or gynecologic oncologies about their practices since the presentation that he gave. I do think that he deserves tremendous credit for doing this study. This is a very difficult study to have completed. And I think that the findings are important, but I don't think they've necessarily changed practice in our country. I suspect that it has probably changed practice in Europe. You know, when I first heard the data, I did discuss it with my patients in detail, and it's difficult for them to understand, well, why have you been following my CA125s all the time and now you're not going to follow them anymore? You know, that's a very difficult concept. But I think where I use this information mostly is that when somebody has recurred with an isolated CA125 elevation, I do not recommend treatment, especially off of a clinical trial, because the study showed that there's no difference in survival, but quality of life was worse for those patients who were notified of their CA-125 rather than those who were not. So I tend to discuss more of a surveillance type treatment or maybe treat with tamoxifen in that setting. But I do counsel my patients extensively about symptoms of recurrence to monitor, because I think that's the important issue, is really you want to be able to identify when these patients even start to have the minimal amount of symptoms so that you can start to treat them, because otherwise you end up in a situation where maybe they end up with a bowel obstruction in the hospital and so forth, because that did happen to me. But it's very challenging when you're discussing these surveillance issues with patients and you have to say to them, you know, we may monitor your CA-125 closely, but there's not going to be a difference in your survival based on what we do. You can't say that to somebody, you know? You have to word this carefully, because you don't want someone to feel demoralized or feel hopeless in the setting of a recurrence. And there is definitely a lot of anxiety that women have based on even a slight elevation in their CA-125. If their CA-125 was 8 and then all of a sudden if it's 25, they can be very worried about that. And so I have my concerns too about the anxiety that we're provoking or emotional well-being. But I found that I'm pretty comfortable with how I've integrated these findings into my practice. I do think that of utmost importance, we have to discuss quality of life issues with our patients. And I'm hoping that the GOG will continue to study, you know, patients who have a biologic relapse or elevation in their CA-125 or minimal disease separately in clinical trials. And there's a very important study that was presented by Dr. Hertaux regarding tamoxifen or thalidomide in this patient population. And essentially, tamoxifen came out as the agent of choice in patients who have a biologic relapse compared to thalidomide at any rate. But he has continued to promote study of women who have an elevated CA-125 or minimal amount of disease. And I'm hopeful that he can do further clinical trials with the gynecologic oncology group and patients in this situation, because it would be nice as a clinician to be able to offer a patient something.
Absolutely. And I mean, I guess, you know, when that was first presented, people talk about not doing CA-125s, and I don't think that's going to happen. But as you say, this idea of, you know, kind of reminds me, I was flashing on follicular lymphoma, where they just had this big presentation of, you know, watch and wait versus rituximab. But what you're seeing in practice is a lot more use of rituximab rather than watch and wait. And it kind of reminds me of what you were just saying about tamoxifen. If you have, of course, rituximab is very effective, but if you have something that doesn't cause a lot of toxicity, it's a lot easier to use it in an asymptomatic patient.
And I do think it works clinically in select situations. And actually, there was a GOG trial that evaluated tamoxifen in patients with refractory ovarian cancer. And the response rate was approximately 20%. So it does have some activity.